Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am honored to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Bruce Kent, who is a longtime peace activist in England. He was born in London on June 22, 1929. He joined the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in 1960. He was General Secretary and Chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament from 1980 to 1990, the Chair of War on Want, 1974 to 76, the President of the International Peace Bureau, 1985 to 92, the President of the London Region United Nations Association, 1990 to 91. He's laughing, but this is going to be a discussion of decades of peace activism with much for us to learn. Bruce Kent was Secondary School Environment Development Disarmament Project. It worked on that from 1993 to 1995. He was the UK organizer of the Hague Conference of 1999, which was, of course, following up the 1899 Hague Conference. He is currently Vice President of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Vice President of Pax Christi, and Vice President of the Movement for the Abolition of War, which you will find at abolishwar.org.uk. Bruce Kent, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David. It sounds like my obituary, really.
I'm very happy to say it isn't, but it would be a remarkable one, nonetheless. How early did you get involved in working on peace? How did you come to that career decision?
Well, it was very accidental, really. I was assistant priest in London, and some people got me interested in Pax Christi, the Catholic peace movement, really because of what was happening to young Spanish boys and Portuguese boys back in 1958, when they were called up to fight in Africa, and some of them refused, and they were treated very badly and put in prison. And so I got a bit involved in that way, and from then on, from Pax Christi, I got involved with the campaign for nuclear disarmament, and then the campaign against the arms trade, and it kind of went out of control, really. It went on and on.
Well, maybe we should back up to becoming a priest. How did that come about?
Becoming a priest?
Yes.
Well, I went to a Catholic school. I was very inspired by a number of the people I met there, and I thought this is something that God could want me to do, and so I gave it a whirl. I had a bit of trouble at home because my father, who was a very nice bloke, but he wasn't a Catholic, and was brought up as an English speaker in Quebec, so he was quite anti-French and anti-Catholic. So I had a bit of problem there, but eventually I went to a seminary after I finished with Oxford and finished with the army, and was ordained in 1958.
There was an interesting word in there, army. You were in the military during World War II.
Just after. I was called up. Everybody in England, conscription lasted until probably about 1962 or 3. And so in 1947, when I was 18, I was called up and I went into the army. I had no scruples whatsoever. I never thought of anything different. I was brought up in a very militarist tradition. My father had been in the First World War. In my school, it had a cadet corps, was very militarist. And so I just went in, and thank God I never had to do anything very nasty, or nasty at all, really. But I just went without any scruples or any thought at all.
If you were called up today, you would take a different course?
Oh, I think today I'd have a very different position. I don't know that I'm 100% pacifist, but I certainly think the military have got to observe moral laws and behave according to morality and law, and I think that pretty well excludes military activity for most people now.
And now you are retired from the priesthood, but still Catholic?
Very Catholic. I'm very involved in my parish. I'm what you call a critical Catholic. I'm much heartened by some of the things this new Pope Francis has done. He's really it seems to me, brought things back to fundamentals, and I'm very encouraged by that. But I think that there's a lot going for the Catholic Church. We have a very good parish. I meet people of every class and description there. I'd never meet them otherwise. In a sense, I meet God's people when I go to my parish, and I'm happy to do my bit while I can.
I confess to not being religious myself, but I spoke recently to a Pax Christi group here in the United States and have another one on my schedule for next year, and greatly admire Pax Christi. I wonder if you could tell people where Pax Christi came from and what it's all about.
Yes, I'd be glad to, because I don't think it's enough known. Pax Christi was a development after the Second World War, and it began because a bishop who'd been in a German prison for supporting the Jews, his housekeeper or his secretary afterwards, a Madame Claudette, said to him, we ought to form an organization to bring reconciliation between the Germans and the French. And so I think in 1947, this small group began, and they had pilgrimages and prayer meetings and things, and made a kind of bond. And from then it grew into a more politically dynamic and more concerned with war generally and arms trade and conscientious objection and all sorts of things. It's now in about 50 different countries around the world, some of which are concerned with things like military bases, some with conscientious objection, some like us here with nuclear weapons. But it's a very, I think, very active part of the Catholic Church, and I'm quite proud of it.
The campaign for nuclear disarmament, I don't know that everyone in the United States is familiar with that.
Well, the campaign for nuclear disarmament began in 1958, it was at a time when people over here in Britain suddenly realized that we were in the nuclear weapon game. It was all done secretly. The decision was made in 1947, but it was never put to Parliament. It was all a secret thing. But by late in the 50s, people realized that we were testing nuclear weapons and we were going for nuclear weapons ourselves. And then a great movement of indignation. And at that time, we were only the third country in the world after America and the Soviet Union. And so we really thought we could shift things. So it was a very active campaign from about 58 until the mid-60s, at which time the Vietnam War loomed heavily, and many activists went off to campaign about the Vietnam War. But then it resurged again in a quite astonishing way. I became the General Secretary in January 1980, and I think when I got to my desk, we had about 3,000 members. But within 2 years, we had 130,000 members. You can imagine what that meant in terms of organization. Because of the issue of cruise missiles, which the United States wanted to put in our country, the language of Reagan talking about the evil empire, the knowledge of the accident, because people didn't know how close we came to disaster at Cuba and other times because of human misunderstanding. So there was a passionate feeling. With Gorbachev's arrival in the late 80s, the heat rather went out of it, but now it's resurging because of the likelihood that not just 9 countries, but 19 countries or 129 countries will get nuclear weapons unless we take serious steps to negotiate their abolition. We've done it with chemical weapons. There's no reason at all why we can't do it with nuclear weapons, apart from the insane nationalism of the countries that have got them, including my own.
You described taking a membership organization from 3,000 to 100,000 as if you were just in the right place at the right time, but I imagine there was a great deal of strategy and work involved. What did you learn from the process?
Fantastic work. We had, when I came in January 1980, we had 3 members of staff, of whom I was one. Within 2 years, we had 30 members of staff. I was just going out and hiring people on the spot. Any enthusiast had a job because there was so much work to do. Simply recording and encouraging groups The great thing was that in the early CNDs, in the 60s, there had been this network, so it was like a balloon that was a bit flat. When all the new members came in the 80s, the balloon just reinvigorated itself and filled up, and so we had the structure in which to organize it. And I think we did a lot of good, especially, I must say here, the women who camped at Greenham Common, the cruise missile base, had a remarkable effect on women all around the world. That people always ask me, how are the women doing at Greenham? And I think women felt very empowered by the struggle that their sisters had shown over cruise missiles. So it was a very good time to be alive.
We are speaking with Bruce Kent, longtime peace activist, a great deal to recount and to teach the peace movement of today. What were your best experiences, most positive experiences in terms of successful activism against war over the years?
Well, I suppose the most vivid memory I have of experiences was in November, probably of 1980, when I had said, oh, we mustn't try a big demonstration. We'll never get enough numbers. And I was down there. It was the day of the United Nations Disarmament Day, October, November 1980. And in Trafalgar Square, which is in the center of London, there's a big square. And I just couldn't believe it. People were coming into that square until, 5 o'clock in the evening, 6 o'clock, they were still coming into the square. And I suddenly realized that we had really hit the button for public opinion. The same thing, I might say, another occasion, even bigger, was in 2003, when over a million people met in Trafalgar Square and in Hyde Park to try to stop Tony Blair from having any part in the war on Iraq. We didn't succeed, but I think we did long term, because our government refused from Parliament to have a war with Syria. But those two experiences really felt me. And I think, speaking to your audience, also, of course, in 1982, going to Central Park in New York and seeing all these people, hundreds of thousands of people, for the big special session on disarmament that took place in Central Park. So those were the big memories, but there were lots of little memories of really wonderful, decent people whose names will never be printed, who's never going to be famous, but who just put their time and energy into campaigning in their locality. And that was really quite humbling. So many nice people.
And, of course, on that day, February 15th, 2003, many of us were in the streets in New York as well, and in cities around the world, people have a memory of that day. The peace movement seems to rise and shrink. Do you think that the peace movement is at a weak point or a strong point? Is it growing? Is it receding? And what about public opinion in general about the question of war? Has it become enlightened at all over the past three quarters of a century?
Well, I think that it's now kind of halfway house. I think the tide is coming in, but it's not in yet. I think people are beginning to realize, after Afghanistan, after Iraq, after Syria, that war does not solve problems. And I think that any politician here talking about going to war would have a really tough time. I think it has not reached the same level as it should, like environmental concerns, because, of course, war is a major environmental problem. But it hasn't reached that level of interest. It hasn't reached the level of interest of amnesty and human rights, although war, of course, is a major violation of human rights. But I think that we're on the cusp or something like that, the tip of a wave. I think it's going to break. And your work, I might say, is certainly going to help us to move forward.
Well, maybe I should ask your advice, as we're trying to start up a new project called World Beyond War. what can you recommend we best avoid and best pursue in trying to create and ride a wave with this?
Well, it's very much a matter of education and culture, isn't it? And I think the key thing is that we have an influence in the media, on educational processes, on national celebrations, and that we do it together. I mean, I've always looked on the peace movement as a kind of orchestra, and there's somebody playing the banjo and there's someone playing the piano. Well, in the peace movement, somebody's playing conscientious objection, somebody's playing the arms trade, someone is playing nuclear weapons, and we've got to work together. And I think we can do that internationally as well as nationally. I think it's moving. Of course, in this country now, I don't know whether you're getting it, but we are getting absolutely dosed with all the glories of the First World War. Dosed with it. Every media has got something to say about the First World War, quite uncritically. And we're doing, I think, quite a good job in presenting the First World War as an absolute disaster, an unnecessary disaster. So that's our immediate focus here. But I think that war in general is losing its popularity. It's not seen to be the automatic solution to problems, as it seemed to be under Reagan and people like that.
You recently met with World War I conscientious objectors or family members.
Yes, we had a marvelous day. May the 15th is International Conscientious Objectors Day. And my wife, Valerie Fossati, who's very active in Pax Christi and other bodies, she got together with others, with the Quakers, with the Peace Pledge Union, and researched over 60, nearly 70 of the conscientious objectors of the First World War, and made contact with their families. And on the 15th of May, on a beautifully sunny day, and it's not always sunny in London, as you'll find out, on a beautifully sunny day, we had nearly 400 people in Tavistock Square, where there's a great stone dedicated to conscientious objectors. And they all read out a little bit of history of their fathers or their grandfathers who had been COs. Some were COs for religious reasons, some were political, some were anarchists, some were socialists. They all had different reasons. And they suffered terribly. Though you won't know the name Fenner Brockway, but he lasted till he was 99. He was put in prison for 9 months, in solitary for 9 months, and the first 3 months only bread and water. So they really suffered heavily. Some of them died. They weren't released until 1919, some of them. Some of them died from the tuberculosis and the pleurisy and things they got in prison. So it was a very moving moment. Some of these old ladies, came down from the north of England, and there were tears in their eyes because they said, nobody has ever honored my grandfather or my father before. So it was a wonderful day.
It was horrible treatment, but it's remarkable that you have such a large ceremony honoring them and that there is a large stone honoring them. If there is any monument to such conscientious objectors in the United States, I'm unaware of it. Our cities are dominated, as yours are, by war monuments.
Well, you've certainly got conscientious objectors, First World War and Second World War.
There were certainly
people, and of course the Vietnam War, many people, and I admire them even more, I think, those in the military who refused to obey particular orders. I call them conscientious objectors, and we've had some of those, and they're very remarkable people, because they've been imprisoned and court-martialed because they wouldn't do what they were told to do, because they said it was immoral. And I think they are very brave men.
Absolutely. We're trying to build a movement to abolish war, and you have been working on a movement to abolish war by that name, Movement for the Abolition of War. The website is abolishwar.org.uk. When did that organization get started, and how?
Well, it sprang out of the meeting that you mentioned. In 1999, we had a centenary event in The Hague, a peace movement about abolish war, and it was organized very much by some of the people from the States. Cora Weiss, for one, I was a great organizer, and nearly 10,000 people came. including the then Secretary of the United Nations, Kofi Annan. And at the end of it, it was all about abolishing war. Joseph Rotblat, who was one of the scientists, in fact, I think the only scientist who refused to work on the bomb once he realized what was going to be used for, he said we ought now to start not just against particular weapons, but against the whole concept of war itself. And so I said, okay, Joe, we'll start. So we began, and we've been going for 10 years. We're open, of course, to anybody. We don't limit ourselves to people who would say they were strictly pacifist. We say anybody who wants to abolish war is welcome. And so we've had military people in it and still have it. And I think it's helping to change the culture. Nothing changes things immediately, but we all give a little push in the right direction.
There's a line of thought quite common in the United States, including in the mind of our current president, that would suggest that the way to abolish war is through war. We'll have the right wars in the right places, and we'll beat down those people who are launching bad wars, and in the end, we will have peace through war. Presumably, when you say you include members of the military, it's not with that approach.
No, it's ridiculous. Your president, I have to say, maybe he's got lots of good qualities, but your president, in terms of peace and war, has been such a major disappointment. I can't imagine how anybody can get a Nobel Peace Prize on the basis of one speech made in Prague, I think, in Czechoslovakia, and then he gets a Nobel Prize. He talked about the abolition of war. He's busy renewing United States nuclear arsenals. He's talking about, as you said, peace through war. It's really lamentable. He's got, then Guantanamo Bay is still operating against the whole rule of law. I mean, I was brought up, when I was at university, I did law. And I was brought up to believe that you were innocent until you were proved to be guilty. That was the Anglo-Saxon rule of law. Guantanamo Bay is exactly the opposite. You're guilty until you can prove yourself innocent. And we won't let you prove yourself innocent. I mean, Obama inspired such hope. He gave all of us, it was like Pope Francis almost, enormous enthusiasm. And then suddenly, God, it all went very wrong, and it's still going wrong.
Well, I confess to having skipped the hope stage, but I'll agree with you on the lamentable, disappointing performance. One of the projects that you're working on now and have been in recent days, I understand, is related to the Trident weapon system. Can you tell people what that is and what needs to be done with it?
Yes, Trident is really an offspring of United States technology. Trident is a submarine. We have four of them. And on the submarines, there are, I think, eight missiles and warheads. Each one of the warheads is enough to do 10 times the devastation of Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And we first got the Trident in about 1980. We started on that. And now the current fleet is wearing out, and we have to decide whether to spend massive sums of money. I don't know what £100 billion would be, but it probably double that in dollars, on a new set. And the present government is so moved by British nationalism and flag waving that we're going to go ahead and do this. And we're, at the same time, we're busy telling the Iranians they can't have nuclear weapons, but we're telling them that they're good for our security. And I think the time has come in this country when everything has been cut, the health service has been cut, education has been cut, transport has been cut, is to say to people, the money that's going on Trident should go on to the real needs of people, not on the illusion of security through nuclear weapons. And so this has become on the boil now, because when the next government's elected, there'll be a vote on whether we go ahead with Trident or not. So 2015, 2016 is quite a critical time for us. And of course, even more so in that the Scots, who are now having a vote on independence in September, the Scots have said that they will get the existing fleet out of Scotland, where it is now based. They'll have that out of Scotland if they get independence. So there's a lot of cards on the table, and it's a big issue for us at the moment. And of course, we couldn't have the bloody thing without your help, because the missiles come directly from the United States, and we take them back every once in a while to get them remended or adjusted and so on. Our Prime Minister Harold Wilson long ago called them a Moss Bros deterrent. Moss Bros is a big shop in London where you can hire a dinner jacket. And what he was saying was, effectively, we just hire from the United States our missiles. I wish to God you could get a campaign over there to say no more nuclear weapons for Britain. It would be very helpful.
Well, I don't know why we shouldn't and couldn't. I think it could be quite easily done, and I think we'll need to talk about that off the air. But I am struck by your comment about Scotland. I also saw recently the possibility aired that independent Scotland could bring Tony Blair to justice for his war crimes, including the crime of making war. We have the International Criminal Court now investigating the United Kingdom, the first Western nation even investigated for war crimes by that court, which has been so relentless in pursuing African war crimes. And we have, as I'm sure you're aware, the Marshall Islands filing lawsuits insisting that the nuclear nations comply with the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The United States, the parent, the father of all of this madness, doesn't participate in international courts. So the United Kingdom, as the junior partner, is going to bear the brunt of any law enforcement. What are attitudes over there?
Well, I admire anybody who's pursuing that. I don't think they'll manage to do it, because the court's jurisdiction doesn't cover wars of aggression. But I think what you said about the Marshall Islands is the most wonderful step forward, that a country of 60,000 people can take the nine nuclear powers to court, and it can. I think it's brilliant, and we're giving them all the support we can. It was done before once. A little country called Vanuatu realized that there's no UN veto in the World Health Organization. And so they got a resolution to the World Organization calling for an advisory opinion from the World Court on nuclear weapons. And it was very positive, all on our side. Well, people don't know about it, but small countries can show great strength, moral strength.
I think we're going to need them to. We have been speaking with Bruce Kent, longtime peace activist, organizer from the United Kingdom, as they call it. And I'm looking very much forward to seeing you over there, Bruce. And we have an event at 8 p.m. in Conway Hall on July the 2nd, to which everyone...
Well, I'll meet you at Heathrow Airport.
That would be extremely helpful. Yes, indeed. Bruce Kent... Movement for the Abolition of War, abolishwar.org.uk. Thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Great pleasure.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.